This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. You know, there was a time when we could agree to disagree and still be civil at work, play, and at the dinner table. What happened? Today, political polarization has created a climate where differing viewpoints can lead to disrespect, name-calling, and being blocked on Facebook. Walter Sinnott Armstrong has studied political polarization, spent part of his career teaching people to argue, and just released the book Think Again, How to Reason and Argue. He is the Chauncey Stillman Professor of Practical Ethics in the Department of Philosophy at Duke University. Walter Sinnott Armstrong, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Tell me why you wrote this book.
I wrote this book because the current political climate drives me crazy. You go on the internet and try to talk to people in reasonable ways about reasonable issues, and you just get yelled at, and the trolls attack you, and they call you names, and they're not listening to you. They interrupt you. It's really bad because we have to live together. We live in the same country, and we have a lot of the same goals. So I want to figure out why we can't work together and try to use that analysis to figure out what we can do about it.
All right. So you've been thinking about it. Why do you think this is happening?
Well, it's obviously an extremely complex issue, and I don't want to, you know, suggest that one thing makes all the difference, but my particular angle is arguments. I think people don't understand each other anymore, and if you think somebody's doing something that's dangerous for your country and you don't understand why, you're going to hate them, and that leads to this intense polarization. So we need to start to understand each other, not just understand which positions we hold, but why we hold them. Often figuring out the reasons for a position can make you like the person a little more or at least hate them a little less.
Now, this does get, I'm going to point to social media here. We just talked about that in our last segment. And clearly, you know, you're an intelligent man. You're not going to blame everything on social media. But that does have an impact on this, it seems to me, because number one, you don't have to be face to face. Number two, you don't have to use a lot of words, right? And you don't even have to stick around to defend whatever you just tweeted.
Exactly. And so the atmosphere of social media does not fit our evolutionary instincts. We have a tendency, we've evolved to have this tendency, to feel moral outrage at people who disagree with us and say things that we think are immoral. Well, if you have to do that face to face, it's quite costly, but it's free on the internet. Mm. On the other hand, it turns out that some of the deepest polarization and antagonism occurs among groups of the population that don't use the internet as much, such as older people. There's not as much among the younger people, more among the older people. They're not using the social media as much. So that casts some doubt on that explanation. I still think it's part of the story, but it's not the whole story.
All right. So what else is going on? And again, let's start aiming at what can be done. In other words, what have we lost or what is it that we're doing that we weren't doing before? And then how do we repair this?
So I think one problem is that we've developed an atmosphere of Democrats versus Republicans. It's like Duke versus Chapel Hill. You know, I was told by my students it's immoral to cheer for Chapel Hill. And it's just a team mentality. And when that starts entering politics, we've got a problem. I don't listen to your views. I don't listen to your policies. If you're a Republican, I reject you. Or if I'm a Democrat and if I'm a Republican, I reject you. I reject the other way around. I think I got
right. Well, and the friend of my enemy is in it. You know, all that sort of thing. And we're seeing that in the highest circles to reject the policies of your predecessor. We're seeing that right now. And Donald Trump, if Obama did it, it must be wrong. Let's not bother to think about this. And he's got, you know, 60 million people who say he should still be president. So they agree too.
Yeah. And we also see it on the other side. We see it on both sides.
Yeah, that's right.
As soon as Kennedy announced his retirement, the Democrats said, no matter who Trump nominates, we're going to oppose him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm sorry. At least we ought to listen to him and listen to his reasons. We shouldn't just announce publicly that we're going to reject it regardless of who it is and how good that person is.
All right. So you've got some practical ideas about how we construct an argument. Actually, I'd like to get into, you know, the ways in which we argue in general. And I don't know that we need to get into a technical distinction between induction and deduction. But I think what you talked about there, making arguments that either have really compelling evidence or, you know, perhaps tangential evidence, this is part of what where we start to go wrong, right?
Absolutely. People will, for example, say, well, there are immigrants who are, you know, murderers and burglars and rapists. Therefore, you know, immigrants are dangerous. And whoa, you just generalized to this giant class of people from a small sample. Now, there are two mistakes you can make there. One is to think that all immigrants are dangerous. The other mistake is to say, no, immigrants are all lovely, wonderful people. No, some of them are, in fact, criminals. Both sides usually have some truth. If it were not the case that both sides had some truth, there wouldn't really be a controversy about it.
Well, here's the other thing that happens there. You put out that this killing happened in Iowa, therefore we need to build a wall, right? And and somebody a little more different point of view says, you know, that was one killing, and lots of people, including Native Americans who are native to this country, also commit murder. Therefore, your argument is now we're going to argue about your argument. And the overarching argument about immigration policy has totally been lost in the validity of your evidence, right?
Well, I think what you want to do is to point out how bad the argument is, and generalizing from a small sample is bad. I hope that doesn't put an end to the discussion of the policy. You've got to do a lot more after that, but you want to get rid of those red herrings that are driving you apart and that are clouding the issue. If somebody says, look, you're either for the wall or you're for open borders, you ought to go, no, that's crazy. Of course I'm not for either of those. Mm-hmm. You can't run an argument, you know, like that, because that premise is false. Does that solve the issue? No. But it avoids a lot of wasted time with people saying stupid things that are not really moving us ahead.
Yeah, but here's the thing. As a practical matter, if I have posited the argument that one killing somewhere in America by someone who is undocumented means that all people who are undocumented are dangerous, if I said that to you and you came back to me and said, totally irrational, that doesn't make any sense, am I going to say to you, oh, God, Frank, you're right. That didn't make any sense. I'm not sure why I even – that's not what I'm going to do, is it?
Of course not. Of course not. And that's why you shouldn't say you're irrational. That doesn't make any sense. Now you're just acting like a troll on the internet. We don't want either side to do that. My suggestion is quit making assertions. Start asking questions. You go, oh, that's horrible. Let's you know, get some common ground here. That was horrible. I think we got to try to stop that kind of thing. How often do you think that happens? Does it happen to all kinds of immigrants? Is there some way to tell which immigrants are going to be dangerous and which ones are not? Let's quit making so many assertions and start asking more questions. I think that'll help a lot.
So that does suggest that you put yourself in the mind of your, let's call them an opponent for the moment, and say, well, wait a minute, what were they thinking when they said that? And now let me think about how they see this and begin to empathize, as you suggest, oh my goodness, a murder, that's horrible. Somebody's lost a child. Oh, that's, and then now you and I have grounds for agreement, and I'm the one who had to make that, we'll call it a concession for the moment. I heard something that I would consider irrational. I'm not going to talk about the validity of the argument. I'm going to actually get to the emotion that generated the, and there we have some sympathy. Let's work from there.
Right. And empathy is crucial, as you said. So we've got a few interventions that we're trying to use to try to undermine polarization. One of them is to get people to ask questions, but another one is to try to induce empathy by saying, okay, you're a Republican, I'm a Democrat. Now, what I'm going to do is try to describe your view on the issue. You try to describe my view on the issue. And then we can have people rate whose description is more accurate, not which is correct, but accurate to represent the view of the other side. By practicing that, you come to understand the other side and to try to imagine good arguments for the other side. So we're going to try to set up a website that does that and rewards people for doing it well, in the hope that that will induce empathy, as you said.
But who would come to that website? Because this leads to the other issue, which is that these techniques that you described, and we'll talk about some more as this segment continues, suggest that this is an army of the willing, that there are people who really want to have a conversation. It does suggest to me that there's a common problem they'd actually like to solve and not just scream about stuff that's in the headlines, kind of on an hourly basis. So it seems to me there are two very different contexts. If I put people in a room, they want to solve a problem. We need to come up with a framework by which we will have a discussion so that it does not devolve. That's not the internet, right? That's not Twitter. Twitter is not the context in which we're trying to solve anything.
So what I say in the book is we ought to take the population and divide it into thirds. The third to the left, well, they're probably going to agree with me anyway. A third to the right, they're not going to listen to me. I think we should direct our discussions to the third in the middle. And there's a lot of evidence that people in the middle are, first of all, sick of the extremes. And second of all, they're looking for answers. And they really will listen to reasons on both sides because they maybe haven't made their mind up yet. Now, some people say they're in the middle and they're not really in the middle, so there's no panacea.
Everybody's here. In the middle. Everybody's a centrist and people are to the right and left of me.
But there really are some people in the middle. And by the way, they're the ones that decide elections, depending on which way they go. So I think if you think of the middle third or maybe the middle 10%, if you're really cynical, then that's where you target your arguments. And the fact that other people don't listen, that's just life. Too bad. Not everybody's going to listen to you.
So tell me more about this website, how it's set up and what it's designed to do.
Well, I wish I could tell you more because we're still in the process of setting it up. But for example, one plan is to go to states where there are senators running in the fall and say, okay, these are the two senators in your state. Which one are you for? What do you think the other person stands for? And then get two people who are supporting different senatorial candidates to talk about how accurate the representation is and to run it during the month of October and then look at their voting patterns in November and try to figure out how that discussion made a difference. So it's a research work in progress. I'd love to report back when we get some results.
But again, this is an army of the willing, but it's a good sample to get because these are people who do matter and whose votes matter. And if there was a place where they could have rational discourse, this might be it. So a great test for how this might
be. I just want to create a location where people who want to do that can go because I think that once people start having more civil discourse, then they'll see that it's useful and more people will go. Right now, there might not be very many people, only 10% of the U.S. population. Wait a minute, that's 30 million people. Mm-hmm. And so that's still a lot of people. If you can get a small number, it'll be a bigger number. Changing our culture is not going to happen overnight, but it's something we've got to do if we're going to solve some of the problems that we face.
What about we hear so much that facts don't matter anymore, and you can be presented with a whole list of evidence that is just grounded in the best kind of research possible, and then there's this emotional argument on the other side that doesn't seem to be taking, and this can work in both directions, it just does not seem to be taking any of that into account.
That certainly happens. Notice if it's one-third to the left and one-third to the right, that means two-thirds of the people are not going to listen to the facts. But the one-third in the middle still does want to figure this out and try to figure out what's going to work and what's not going to work. So people get very cynical, and they have a lot of reason to be cynical because most people today are not paying attention to the facts. But there are a lot of people out there who do pay attention to facts and reason, and those are the people I want to cultivate.
You talk about you cite a case study in your book where a black activist, a very famous case here in Durham, Ann Atwater, a black activist and a KKK leader by the name of C.P. Ellis, were brought together in the 70s. This was under the umbrella of a charrette. The idea was education policy. Desegregation was not happening in Durham schools. How are we going to make this happen? Let's put a black activist and a Klan leader in a room together, and they can't come out until they've come up with a solution. Right. And they did. Right?
Yes, after 8 hours a day for 10 days, part of the thing we need is more patience. People expect, I've got 5 seconds to do a one-liner or 140 characters to try to convince somebody to change their position. That ain't going to happen. You have to get people who can spend enough time to really work through the issues. The second thing is you got to listen to reasons. What really helped in that case was Ann Atwater and C.P. Ellis said to each other, but why do you adopt the position you do? And C.P. Ellis said, because I want my kids to get a good education, and I think your policies are going to ruin the system. And Ann Atwater said, well, in that case, I'd be opposed to it too. Instead of saying, I'm for this, I'm against this, they said, why? And then they could work together. Then they could look for compromises that would help both sets of kids.
And again, they were thrown into a room. They both agreed to be together, although when you read what they said about each other before they met, they clearly weren't looking forward to it, right?
They were bringing weapons and stuff.
They were calling each other all kinds of names that I won't say on the radio. But they did it, and I think because both realized that they both wanted a good education, and this was going to be the system. So they were offered a seat at the table or not. They took the seat, and they had a very particular problem that they were both deeply invested in and both wanted to solve. It seems to me, again, I'm going back and over and over this. It's not what you do on Twitter. You're not solving anything when I do the, you know, the global warming tweet on when then I do the racial profiling tweet 8 seconds later. I'm not solving any of that.
People have lost faith in talking to other people and reasoning with them. So I think it's important to bring out cases like that. And it's not alone. Megan Phelps Roper left the Westboro Baptist Church. Daryl Davis has converted people from the Klan. But it takes a long time. It takes patience. It takes sticking your neck out and talking to the other people. I think we've got to have more hope that that can work if we put the effort into it.
Now, are we going to get back to your one-tenth of the population who really is, that's the only group who's really interested in this? I mean, my question is, have we actually lost interest in that kind of rapprochement? Do we really care about that, or are we just happy screaming and being angry?
I don't think there's any we here. A lot of people have. Absolutely. I don't deny that. But a lot of people haven't, and a lot of people want better. The people in the middle, it doesn't take as much effort to talk to them. The people on the extremes, cases like Ann Atwater and Megan Phelps Roper, show that even those can be accomplished, but it's going to take a lot more time and a lot more discussion, a lot more effort.
And a particular issue that they're working on. Again, not just saying, let's get over our disharmony over left and right. Left and right is not a thing.
It matters that they had a practical goal. Yeah. They both wanted it to work, and something really hinged on it. A lot of these discussions on the internet don't really matter. You're just throwing out words to make yourself look smart.
And how much of that is because we're actually feeling a little bit powerless? We have a representative government that is controlled a lot by corporate money right now. And so everybody gets that your vote, while it counts, it certainly counts, so show up and get out there and vote, is manipulated in so many other ways by big power and lots of money beyond your control. This is the only control I've got.
I think that's absolutely right. People feel powerless. But if you know, what's the solution? People go, let's get rid of gerrymandering. Well, look, that's going to be in the politician's hands too. As an individual, can't do anything about that. What I want to do is give people a way of turning to their neighbor who happens to be in a different political party and having a reasonable discussion and getting along with them a lot better.
You also argue that there are times to argue and times not to argue.
Absolutely. When somebody doesn't want to argue with you, you're just going to waste your time and annoy them and turn them off. It's going to be counterproductive.
And the warning about the false dichotomy, and that's what I think in our two-party system, we just think in dyads, and it's real hard for us to imagine third ways.
Right, and each party has a whole set of positions. So most Republicans agree with the Republican position on all 10 of the issues that Pew surveys cite. And most Democrats agree with the Democratic position on all 10 of the issues that the Pew survey cites. I remember back in the 60s, people would say, well, I'm with the Republicans on like 7 out of 10 issues, but I side with the Democrats on these three. We've lost that ability to go issue by issue and assess the reasons for the policies instead of just which side are you on? Who are you going to cheer for in the competition?
Well, what's going on there, again, in identity? We're seeing 80% of Republicans now strongly favor Donald Trump. That was, and the disparity between party loyalty for their candidates and their parties is now much bigger than it ever was before.
Much bigger than it ever was before. And if you look from Clinton to Bush to Obama to Trump, it's been increasing over that period by a lot. Part of it is just sorting. People who accept the Republican stance are leaving the Democratic Party, going to Republicans, and vice versa. The people who were the moderate wing of the Republican Party are now Democrats. The people who were the conservative wing of the Democratic Party are now Republicans. And that's just sorting it out. So now you've got much stronger opposition to whoever's in power.
So what do you think? How's this going to turn out? Are you optimistic? Can things actually turn around, or are we forever siloed?
I'm optimistic because you mentioned, for example, that the internet creates part of this problem by its atmosphere, by the rewards that people get on the internet. The internet can also be part of the solution. If I try to talk to my neighbor or even to my class, I'm not going to reach very many people. But if we can somehow get a website up that starts to deal with this problem, you can reach hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, on the internet in a way you never could before. So we have to come up with a good solution, advertise it well, encourage people to go to it.
Walter Sinnott Armstrong, Chauncey Stillman Professor of Practical Ethics in the Department of Philosophy at Duke. His book is called Think Again, How to Reason and Argue. Walter, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll talk about a third way coming up and look at healthcare policy. We've argued a lot about that. More on that on the State of Things. Stay tuned.